I'm Gail Harris. Robin Young is off today. It's Here and Now. Six more American soldiers are dead in attacks around Baghdad since midday Monday, bringing the number of service members who have died in Iraq ever closer to the 1,000 mark. The situation has quieted in Sadr City since last night's heavy fighting there. Joining us on the line from Baghdad is Jackie Spinner, correspondent for The Washington Post. And Jackie, what can you tell us about what's happening in Sadr City right now?
Things are relatively quiet today in Sadr City, but there were some pretty serious clashes overnight. At last count, we had 25 Iraqi civilians dead, 145 wounded, that's according to the health minister, and one U.S. soldier was also killed in the fighting overnight. So we were there today. We didn't see a whole lot of activity. The Americans are somewhat ringing the roads into the city, but things have been relatively quiet so far.
Jackie, do we know who these civilians are? That seems like such a high number of both dead and wounded. Are these people getting caught in the crossfire, or who are they?
We don't know exactly who they are. We suspect that they are a number of Mahdi Army fighters. These are supporters loyal to the cleric Muqtada Sadr. We also know that in Sadr City in the past, there have been civilians who have taken up arms against the U.S. forces that you wouldn't technically classify as Mahdi Army, official Mahdi Army fighters. So I would suspect that that's a combination of both of those types of people who were killed overnight.
Let me ask you also about Fallujah. We discovered after the death of seven Marines yesterday, or perhaps were reminded, that U.S. forces haven't been patrolling there since April. And as a result, the insurgents there have apparently strengthened their hold. They're using it as a base for car bombs and launching attacks. And are you hearing any discussion about whether Fallujah would be the next big test of American power? In other words, that it would have to be subdued before elections can proceed in Iraq in January?
Well, that's certainly the scuttle here, whether or not that will actually happen. I think it's nobody knows for certain. The Iraqi people, those, I should say, that are frustrated by the fighting, at least in the capital, express continuously when we talk to them on the street their desire for Fallujah to be taken care of. I'm certain the military would like to see that situation resolved. But, you know, it's been months since the insurgents have taken hold of the city, and the military really hasn't done anything.
Yeah. What's the latest with Muqtada al-Sadr himself? Is he at all in public at the moment?
No, he has not been seen since the negotiations, and things have remained relatively quiet in Najaf. So that situation, at least for the time being, seems to be resolved. The larger issue we have here today in Baghdad and in the rest of the country is we've had at least five U.S. soldiers killed today, unknown number of casualties in another attack, and we're just kind of waiting to see what the count is. So it looks like today is shaping up to be a rather difficult day for U.S. forces once again.
Mm. Jackie Spinner, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jackie Spinner is correspondent for The Washington Post. And joining us now is Bathsheba Crocker, a fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. Welcome, Bathsheba.
Thank you.
You are the co-author of a study that's going to be coming out tomorrow called Progress or Peril, Measuring Iraq's Reconstruction. So clearly you've spent a lot of time trying to figure out how things are going there. And I wonder, what's your assessment? Is the glass half full or half empty?
Well, I think if we have to put it in those terms, at the moment it looks half empty, according to the study that we've done. We spent 6 months doing intense amounts of research looking at literally thousands of data points from media reports, from U.S. government and United Nations sources, from the public polling that's been done in Iraq, and also from a series of interviews we carried out in Iraq. And what we see across a range of sectors that we looked at is that Iraq is still sort of not doing all that well in any of the sectors, again, which range from security to governance to economic opportunity. And I think more worrying, does not seem to be trending in a positive direction yet.
You mentioned in the summary that the Iraqi voice has been a key missing ingredient in most discussions and assessments of Iraq's reconstruction. What did you hear from those Iraqi voices?
Well, we heard, again, a range of things depending on which part of the country we were looking at. One of the interesting things that runs throughout is that we did tend to see a certain level of, I think we would call it guarded or skeptical optimism on the part of Iraqis. They are not yet willing to write off the prospect that things could turn around. So for the longer term, they remain optimistic and patient, but in the immediate term, they are incredibly frustrated across the range of issues that we looked at the pace of reconstruction and the security problems and the economic opportunity or the lack of economic opportunity that they continue to suffer.
As you study Iraq so closely, obviously you're also hearing John Kerry and George Bush exchanging claims about how the U.S. is doing in Iraq. Kerry yesterday called it the wrong war in the wrong place at the wrong time, says he'll have troops out of there in 4 years. George Bush is saying, no, it's actually going very well. How responsible do you think both these candidates are in terms of how they're handling Iraq, how they're speaking about Iraq out on the campaign trail?
Well, I think it's a very difficult balance for both of the candidates, and that's one of the things that we actually address in the report, the sense that the candidates both, I think, feel a need to suggest there will be some exit strategy for U.S. troops, but also that the U.S. will stay the course in Iraq, and I think that's a very difficult balance to strike. I'm not sure that either one of them is striking it perfectly in the sense that I think it's dangerous for policymakers at this point to suggest that U.S. troops could come home anytime soon. On the other hand, I think it's also somewhat disingenuous to suggest that an enormous amount of progress is being made in Iraq. We have found that we're not yet at the point where we can claim that significant progress is being made in Iraq.
Well, Bathsheba Crocker, thank you so much for taking time for us and also for your report.
Thank you.
Bathsheba Crocker is a fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. She is the co-author of a study that will be released tomorrow called Progress or Peril: Measuring Iraq's Reconstruction. If aliens were trying to talk to us, what might that sound like? Here's one Hollywood version. That's from the classic Steven Spielberg film, Close Encounters of the Third Kind. But how would real extraterrestrials reach out to Earth? While a recent transmission from outer space is raising some eyebrows, scientists say it could be, just possibly, communication from an alien civilization. Joining us on the line to discuss potential alien communication are Dr. Bruce Betts of the Planetary Society, which was co-founded by Carl Sagan in 1980, and Dr. Chris Rose, a professor of electrical and computer engineering at Rutgers University. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Dr. Betts, I want to start with you because you work for the SETI at Home project, which analyzes radio signals from outer space using the largest radio telescope in the world in Puerto Rico. Is it just scientists who are listening or other people, ordinary folks, who are turning an ear to the universe?
At this point, it's basically just scientists because you're trying to sort out signals from that you don't know what you're looking for and you don't know where in the radio spectrum you're listening.
Tell us a little bit about this signal. Why do you think it could be from outer space and why might it not be?
Some of the news reports have blown it a little out of proportion. The SETI at Home group went and looked at roughly their 200 best possible candidates as extraterrestrial signals and observed them again. All of them looked less likely at the end of the observations than before to be actual extraterrestrial signals, except this one, which score went up a little bit, but it still shows some things that make us think in all likelihood it's almost certainly not a signal from ET, but we keep looking.
It is intriguing, isn't it? Well, we actually have a recording of a transmission that was detected by the Arecibo telescope in Puerto Rico. This is a typical transmission that has been converted to sound. I don't know. Sounds like a lot of static to me, Dr. Betts. And I guess your website says that if this were an alien communication, it would sound more like a whistle?
Yeah, it depends on what what type of communication, whether it's constant or variable. But yes, it certainly, if you converted it to sound, you could detect it as something a little more coherent. But they can also be buried in the static, so that's why you're trying to look in the details.
Well, and it also brings up an interesting wider issue, which is, what is the best way for us to communicate with distant planets? And Dr. Rose, I want to turn to you. You say that, that radio signals may not be the way to go. Why not?
I wouldn't say that it's not the way to go. It's one way to go. But if you look at the energy required to actually send a signal over very long distances, radio tends to dissipate. So that led us to begin to look at the energetics of sending a message of a particular size. And what we found was that for large messages, and it was surprising, that inscribing it in some sort of material and sending it somewhere can be vastly more efficient from an energy standpoint. So the conclusion, or one possible conclusion, is that maybe you should also be looking for little packages. And I say little packages, but, you know, they'd probably be encased in a big rock. That was the example we used in the paper. But you should use material messages as well, and maybe you want to look for those, too.
Well, it's an interesting image of somebody out there across space kind of lobbing things at us. Dr. Betts, what do you think about that?
I think they're both worth looking, but if you're looking for a beacon, the initial, hey, we're out here, I would tend to favor the radio and optical looks, but I think it's all worth looking into.
I guess the final intriguing question, which is, what do you gentlemen think is the likelihood that we are going to have some kind of communication with an alien civilization in our lifetimes? Frankly, I'm rooting for it.
I would say it is possible, and we look forward to it, but it will be challenging. It's kind of the ultimate example of something that's not very likely to pan out at any one time, but if you ever succeed, you've got what's arguably the most significant discovery in the history of civilization.
Well, gentlemen, thank you both so much. It's such a fascinating topic.
Thanks for the invitation.
Dr. Bruce Betts of the Planetary Society and Dr. Chris Rose, a professor of electrical and computer engineering at Rutgers University. Some of the other sounds generated from space transmissions that scientists are sifting through as they listen to the stars. Later in the program, the new war of words John Kerry is waging against President Bush on the war in Iraq. And just ahead, one military expert's view of how the Pentagon should redraw its map of the world. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Gail Harris. It's Here and Now. The 9/11 attacks fundamentally changed the way we see the world. But from a military standpoint, Thomas Barnett has been arguing for over a decade that the world has changed. Barnett is a defense analyst at the Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island, and author of the book, The Pentagon's New Map. In the book, he advocates a change in the U.S. military, away from a force set up to defend against other great powers, countries he calls core countries, and toward a force set up to defend against what he calls gap countries. I began our conversation by asking him to explain the difference between core countries and gap countries.
The core countries are those regions of the world that encompass both what we call the West from the Old West from the Cold War era, meaning a United States, a Europe, a Japan, and the former socialist bloc encompassing a Russia, a China, also an India, include also Australia and Argentina, Brazil, Chile. So we're talking about not just what used to be the core of the global economy across the Cold War, meaning the West, but everybody who's emerged as markets and have globalized their economies since about 1980. That's roughly two-thirds out of a global population of 6.5 billion. I counterpose that to what I call the non-integrating gap. And those are the rest of the regions in the world, familiar to us because they are the source of most of the violence and civil wars and terrorism on the planet today.
So are the gap countries our enemies, or is it the fact that these countries are disconnected from the rest of the world?
Yeah, I don't like to use the term enemy so much as these are the sources of mass violence in the system. So the argument is, if you make globalization truly global, if you extend the connectivity of the global economy and bring inside that functioning core, that one-third of humanity that currently sits outside the global economy, noses pressed to the glass, you're going to eliminate over time not only the disconnectedness that exists in these societies, but the violence that that disconnectedness represents and generates.
So is it fair to say that it is really in the best interest of the core countries to figure out a way to help these gap countries connect to everyone else?
Right. I mean, that's an old argument that says peace through trade. And one of the counters you get from realists in my field, or people who like to think more about balances of power between major powers, is that, well, if we concentrate as a country, the United States, on focusing on bringing these smaller, poorer nations into the fold, so to speak, we'll let our guard down and not see some sort of rising threat looming over the strategic horizon from one of our fellow core states, the prohibitive favorite in the Pentagon for the last 10 years being, of course, China. And my answer to that is, yes, peace through trade, but the thing that really keeps the core in line in terms of great power war and that potential is the fact that all the major players have nuclear weapons. And when nuclear weapons enter the scene back in 1945, you have to note, historically, that great power war essentially goes away.
You also say that the Defense Department as we know it will cease to exist, that basically we need two different kind of armies to deal with the world today and the world to come.
Right.
Explain that a little for us.
Well, the problem we've had with the Pentagon, I would argue, over the last 10 years is we keep buying that high-end military for that high-end, high-tech conflict, that great power war. But what we tend to use this force for, overwhelmingly, is to do all the little stuff, all the nation-building and peacekeeping and disaster relief. So over time, we have to rebalance our force in order to reflect that growing workload. Does it matter? Well, it matters, I think, when you go into an Iraq and you demonstrate that you can take down a Saddam Hussein regime with great ease, but then you seem to be underfunded, under-equipped, under-imagined, under-prioritized in terms of the forces you need to have on the ground to do the peacekeeping that follows.
So in essence, you'd give the military perhaps an A or an A-plus in terms of fighting and winning a war, but what would be the grade for what happens next?
D, in the sense that you're not achieving the political objectives. That's my parameter. That's my measure of effectiveness for any military intervention inside this gap.
Well, you believe it was the right move to go into Iraq in the first place, or at least you thought so when you wrote the book. I wonder if you still believe it's possible to transform the Middle East, starting with Iraq.
I believe it was correct to take Saddam down and to seek a Big Bang effect, as they call it inside the Bush White House, because what it does is it draws all the terrorists and their networks into that situation, and it turns all that violence and anger back in on itself. So what we're seeing now is a very tumultuous scene in the Middle East. The terrorists and their grievances are essentially local. When they bring their violence over here, it's really to drive the West out of the Middle East so they can hijack the Middle East out of the world. I think that's a desperate and negative outcome long-term for a billion Muslims living in that part of the world. I think we seek to prevent the terrorists' long-term strategic aims by connecting that Middle East up to the world faster than they can seek to disconnect it.
And in your book, and in some places you applaud what the Bush administration is doing, and others you're very critical. The administration is not known for embracing criticism. What kind of reception are you getting now?
The reception I get is warmest from those who are young enough in their careers, meaning the captains and the colonels of today, who realize that the future I'm describing is both accurate and inevitable, and thus something they have to get straight in their heads. But obviously, when you're a big-picture visionary who's trying to think long-term, what you're going to put out there in terms of judgments and criticisms are going to be hard to accept for anybody working day-to-day, making tough decisions in any political administration.
Tom, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Thomas Barnett is the author of The Pentagon's New Map. Tomorrow on Here and Now, kids as consumers and how Madison Avenue targets them. Also, renowned chef Alice Waters serves up a different approach to school lunch. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Gail Harris. It's Here and Now. Congress is back in session in Washington. President Bush and Democratic challenger John Kerry are out looking for votes across the country, while former President Bill Clinton is sidelined from the campaign for the moment, recovering from open-heart surgery in a New York City hospital. So, for political junkies, there is a lot to discuss and debate in the weeks leading up to November's presidential election. Joining us on the line for a Washington roundup are Andrea Stone, congressional correspondent for USA Today. Hi, Andrea.
Hi, Gail.
And also joining us is Naftali Ben-David, Deputy D.C. Bureau Chief for the Chicago Tribune. Welcome, Naftali.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Andrea, let me start with you. Congress is back in session now. A lot on their plate, clearly. One of the biggest items is what they're going to do about those recommendations in the September 11th Commission report about national security and possibly revamping the nation's intelligence agencies. Also, there was a quote from a spokesman for Senator Bill Frist in today's New York Times that it'll be all 9/11 all the time. Is that the way you see it?
I think so. I mean, I think that's the main thing they've got on their plate. Of course, they have a bunch of appropriation spending bills they've got to get done before the election because everybody wants to get home to campaign. One thing that they won't be getting to is the assault weapons ban, which is going to expire after 10 years this coming Monday, the 13th. You know, President Bush in his 2000 campaign said that he was in favor of renewing the assault ban, but he really hasn't done a whole lot, if anything, to get the House of Representatives to pass it, and that's because Republicans are in charge there. We're going to see that thing expire. So that could become a campaign issue.
Yeah, I think pretty much everything you see from here on out in Congress is going to be some sort of reflection of the campaign. So my guess is you'll see the Republicans bring up issues that they feel work in their favor, everything from lawsuit reform to same-sex marriage and that kind of thing. And in addition, as Andrea was saying, there's just going to be a tremendous amount of talk about national security with the Republicans trying to portray themselves as being active and strong and aggressive when it comes to national security, and the Democrats, of course, trying to show that the Republicans aren't doing enough to embrace the 9/11 Commission recommendations and so on.
I'm not sure really with the 9/11 on their plate, that's got to be done. I'm not sure how much gets actually voted on.
Well, exactly, Andrea. And Naftali, let me put it to you. Congress is only going to be in session for 1 month. We've got all the House members up for reelection, a third of the Senate. Is anything going to get done?
Well, probably very little of consequence is my guess. They do have to go ahead and pass these spending bills. There's going to be a few sort of showcase votes, I think, on hot-button issues, particularly to put Democrats on the spot in certain, especially Democrats who represent more conservative areas. We shouldn't forget that in addition to a presidential election, there's a lot of congressional elections, and the Democrats have at least an outside shot of retaking the Senate. I think most people would agree that's an uphill battle, but nonetheless, it's going to be very close and very hard-fought, and I think which party portrays itself as better in national security is going to be perhaps the most important thing to come out of the next few weeks.
And Andrea, from you on the very tight timetable.
Yeah, I mean, I just don't think there's a lot of time to do anything. And you know, I don't think that members of Congress, especially those who are in those swing districts or very closely contested districts, are going to want to go on record on any more hot-button issues like gay marriage. I think they just want to do what they have to do and get out of town and get back to the campaign.
All right. Well, speaking of the presidential campaigns, Naftali, there are some polls that show President Bush with a commanding lead. Others show a much tighter race. What's your sense about what Senator Kerry needs to do to get back on track in terms of his becoming more aggressive, perhaps? That's one of the things we're hearing.
Yeah, I think there's no question that President Bush has opened up a little bit of a lead. My guess is the polls are going to settle down a little bit. He's still right after the convention and after what I think can fairly be called a terrible month for Senator Kerry. But nonetheless, my guess is that the polls will even out at something with President Bush having a lead of something like, let's say, 5%. And that's at this stage in the campaign, that is definitely worrisome for Senator Kerry. And he's clearly concluded that what he needs to do is go on the offensive in a much more aggressive way, that the idea of trying to stay above the fray is not working. And something we've already seen in the last couple of days is him using the word wrong over and over and over again to talk about President Bush, saying things like the W stands for wrong, and Iraq was the wrong war in the wrong place at the wrong time, and just over and over again trying to get that buzzword out there. And his surrogates, the people who are speaking for him, are speaking in, I think, even more critical terms.
Andrea, I wonder what you make of those poll numbers as well. And also, in a time with volatile poll numbers, how important do the debates become?
Oh, the debates are critical. You know, the poll numbers are interesting. I think pollsters are having an argument among themselves. What are the real numbers that mean something? Is it likely voters, which in our USA Today Gallup poll showed that Bush has a 7-point lead, or is it registered voters, which in which case it's much closer. Bush has 48, Kerry 46, and Ralph Nader, the independent, has 4%. You know, who do you believe? Some people think that it's too early before the election to really gauge who is a likely voter. This is going to get much tighter before Election Day.
And Andrea makes a very good point. I think one of the things that pollsters try to do is they try to figure out who's a likely voter, and that's done in large measure based on voting history. And so, therefore, if there are voters who come out who haven't voted a lot in the past, and that's something that the Democrats in particular are trying to have happen right now, then the polls, I think, can be less reflective of what's going to happen on Election Day than they might otherwise be. And so so the situation is murky, I think, in part for that reason.
And finally, I'd be interested in hearing from each of you on the impact of former President Bill Clinton being sidelined. There was criticism in 2000 that Al Gore should have used him. John Kerry apparently did plan to use him. What impact might his recovery from bypass surgery have, Andrea?
I think, it could have some. I mean, it depends. He's going to need at least 4 to 6 weeks to recover from this bypass. And even then, he's not going to be running around like he was before. They do want to have Bill Clinton, not necessarily in the swing states where he's not exactly that popular, but among the Democratic base, he's by far the most popular Democrat among Democrats. So they were hoping to have him out there. It was interesting that the day before he went in under the knife, he was talking to John Kerry and giving him advice about, what kind of strategy he should be using, how he should do what he should do in the debates coming up. It'll just be interesting to know, how involved he can be and still recover.
Well, at least in terms of strategy, Kerry seems to have been listening because he's now brought on some big names from the Clinton administration. Naftali, you get the last word on this one.
I actually do think that it could be a not insignificant development. I mean, nobody can get the Democratic faithful as worked up as President Clinton. I think he showed at the convention, at the Democratic convention, that he still is able to energize the crowd. He's able to persuade them to give money. And while in and of itself it might not be the most enormous development, it's just coming at the end of a bad few weeks for Senator Kerry. And I think it's something that we shouldn't underestimate. I think he's going to try, I'm sure, to make telephone appearances appearances and video appearances at these various fundraisers that are being held. But I think it's going to be something that in the end, that I think its importance should not be underestimated.
Particularly if he shows up in that last week. We'll have to leave it there for now. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Andrea Stone is congressional correspondent for USA Today, and Naftali Ben-David is deputy D.C. bureau chief for the Chicago Tribune. Still to come, we plunge into dance theater performed in and around the swimming pool of a hotel. You're listening to Here and Now. Medicare premiums for millions of elderly and disabled Americans are going up this year by 17%, or almost $12 a month, the largest increase in the program's 40-year history. News of the increase was released on Friday, 6 weeks earlier than normal. On the campaign trail this weekend, John Kerry seized on rising premiums to bash the Bush administration.
Who are they going to send the bill to? Are they going to send the bill to Halliburton? Are they going to send the bill to Ken Lay at Enron?
No.
You bet they're not. They're going to send the bill to our senior citizens.
Meanwhile, the president didn't mention the increased premiums this weekend, but he did defend his Medicare reforms.
See, the old system, we pay $100,000 for heart surgery, but not the medicine necessary to see to it that the heart surgery wasn't necessary. That didn't make any sense for you, the taxpayers. It didn't make any sense for our seniors. Starting in 2006, seniors will get prescription drug coverage in Medicare.
Well, joining us now is Dr. Mark McClellan, Chief Administrator of the Medicare Program. Mark, welcome.
Gail, it's good to be with you.
So Medicare premiums are going to be going from $66 a month to $78 a month. Why so much?
This is for Medicare Part B, and it reflects the fact that we now have an enhanced Medicare that's providing strengthened access to physician services and new benefits, like new preventive benefits, including a welcome to Medicare physical exam and new coverage for screening tests for diabetes and heart disease. The goal of these programs is to help seniors lower their overall health care costs. Medicare has fallen behind. It's fallen behind on drugs. It's fallen behind on preventive care. And as a result, seniors are stuck with the bills for all of these services that Medicare doesn't cover completely out of their own pockets. And we're changing that.
Well, as you just heard, Democrats, including John Kerry, have criticized President Bush for policies that hurt the poor and middle class. And they point to increases just like this as proof. Your thoughts?
Well, that's why we're focusing on the bottom line for seniors, which is what they're paying out of pocket overall. And if we've got a Medicare program that does not cover preventive care, does not cover drugs, then seniors are going to pay more and more. There are many features in the new Medicare program that are going to help them avoid that. Next year, it includes the new coverage for preventive treatments. It also includes better access to coordinated care plans that enable seniors to stay out of the hospital and stay out of the doctor's office. And in 2006, it's going to include prescription drugs.
The Bush administration had to approve this increase, but does it have any direct control over Medicare premiums?
No, the way that Medicare's Part B services work, this is a premium for Part B services, which is set by the statute, and this is a longstanding statute that says that Medicare and the federal government is going to pick up 75% of the health care costs for seniors, and the Medicare premium covers the other 25%. And it's just applying that longstanding law that's operating here.
And what about the timing of this announcement? If it had happened when it normally does, in mid-October, it would have been right before the election. This is earlier than normal.
Well, the numbers behind the premium for next year were actually made public last March in conjunction with the Medicare trustees report. And we're making a special effort at Medicare right now to get the facts out early and as soon as possible so that seniors can be as well informed as possible about the costs that they're facing as well as all the new benefits that they're going to be receiving in the next year. There's going to be plenty of time in September, October to continue to discuss these issues, but we want to get the facts out as soon as we can so we can have as informed seniors as possible about their Medicare benefits.
Well, thank you so much.
Well, good to talk with you, Gail.
Dr. Mark McClellan is Medicare Administrator. He spoke with us from Washington, D.C. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Gail Harris. It's Here and Now. It's not exactly a chicken or the egg conundrum, but a new study suggests that the widespread appearance of sexual content on television may encourage teenagers to have sex earlier, while others wonder, well, wouldn't that be happening anyway? Joining us on the line now is Liliana Escobar-Chavez, an expert in teen sexuality at the University of Texas School of Public Health. Welcome.
Thank you.
Dr. Escobar-Chavez, what's your answer to that? Would this be happening anyway, or does this material on television prompt earlier behavior?
It is a factor. We need to make an impact on the producers to let them know that this is influencing our adolescents and to see how can we change our television programming so they can learn positive behaviors. And if they're going to show sex, they need to show also how to get protected, how to be safe.
And what are some of the programs that you think are most influential for young people?
Well, kids watch a lot of MTV. In primetime TV, there are lots of programs that are showing sexuality or sexual behavior.
Do you support curtailing this kind of content on television, or do you think that parents should become more aware of it and perhaps somehow restrict television viewing?
Parents have to be more involved with their kids in monitoring what they watch, and it's very important for the parents to talk to their kids about what they are seeing and also watch with them. I think the parents don't know what's happening. Most of them don't have the time to see what the kids watch. They probably are going to be very surprised. Every parent needs to spend more time with their kids and talk with them so that they can learn that it's not reality, mm-hmm. that not everything they watch on TV is reality.
All right. Thank you so much for being with us.
Okay. Thank you.
Dr. Liliana Escobar-Chavez is a professor at the University of Texas School of Public Health. Summer's almost over, but there is time for one last dip in the pool. Make it a hotel pool and toss in some existential dreaming, and you get Hotel Pool, an experimental dance now being performed in Philadelphia by a group called Headlong Dance Theater. Headlong's creators call themselves the Nerds of Dance, as Jennifer Westaway found out when she spoke with two of the troupe's founders, David Brick and Amy Smith.
David, if I can start with you, just lay out for us what Hotel Pool is. What's the premise of it? What happens?
It's a performance piece that takes place in and around a hotel pool. So the audience sits on the deck of the hotel pool, and the dance theater performance takes place in the water and on other parts of the deck.
Is there a story behind it?
There is a bit of a story. A business traveler, a woman played by Amy, finds herself inadvertently in the hotel pool as opposed to her room. She thought she was entering her room, and she starts to have a complicated time in getting out of the pool, and she gets seduced and enticed further and further into the strange world that begins to pop up out of the pool. And one of the things that we did with this piece is rather than import any kind of modern dance or dance vocabulary into the pool, we use their skills as movers to discover what are some interesting ways to move in water and around water and on a slippery deck. And so part of what we do is we invent a vocabulary for the site or the piece that we're making.
Amy, why would you choose a hotel pool? What appealed to you about it?
That's a good question. Well, like many of our ideas for dances, this one started out as a joke. We were sitting around in a hotel pool in Louisville, Kentucky, and no one else was in the pool, and we were, you know, commenting on that, how it's this underutilized area of most kind of corporate hotels. And then we started imagining a guerrilla dance piece that takes place in a hotel pool that we could do wherever we were on tour and with any cast or number of people. And maybe we just have like a couple of, you know, tape players that we stick in the corner, you know, a real low to the ground kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And we just thought that was a really funny idea. And then we spent the next 2 years trying to find a hotel that would let us rehearse and perform there.
Right. This
that
wasn't
was the real challenge.
This wasn't going to be a guerrilla aspect to it.
Right.
Our dream is to take the piece to places and towns that don't have experimental performance or modern dance venues. So, because there's hotels everywhere with these sort of glittering wet spaces in the middle of them.
How about the role that humor plays in your dance and in your performance?
Well, we're sort of known in Philadelphia for being a funny dance company.
Yes.
But what happens is sometimes when we're making a serious work, we come out on stage and people start laughing because they expect to laugh. But in this piece, there is some humor. It's not, I wouldn't say it's a humorous piece, because it's actually a quite dark piece in a way. But it has humorous moments, and I think, like everything, you know, we're always interested in the tragic comedic. You know, we think mm-hmm. sad is sadder when it's near funny, and funny is funnier when it's near sad.
We're terrible judges of when we're funny and when we're dark, and when, you know, we think we're making something really heart-wrenching, and people laugh their asses off, and we think we're doing something funny, and people say, God, that was just so sad.
Tell me about the music that you chose here, composed by Rick Henderson. You've also got some vocals in there, too.
I'm in love with Rick Henderson's music. He's a total sound geek. Any kind of sound, he loves. The pool setting is an incredibly acoustically live space. Sound bounces all around, so I thought he would just go crazy with what you could do with the sound of splashing and whirlpools and voices echoing around in that space. But I also, the space of water is also incredibly evocative, and I think there's a lot of things about memory when people see pools. They think of summer vacations or times that they've swam, and there's, so I wanted him to write some of his beautiful songs. I kind of wanted to collaborate with him in a way that gave him permission to do it all.
Mm-hmm.
And he has. It's one of the aspects of the performance that I'm most excited about.
You called Rick Henderson there a bit of a sound geek. You've also referred to yourselves as the nerds of dance. Amy, does that label still hold?
Yeah, that was me. I say that because we're form nerds. And even if it's not visible, we're always thinking about formal structures. And a lot of our ideas for dances are conceptual ideas, sort of like in the realm of John Cage, and not ideas that are, oh, what a beautiful piece of music, I'm going to make some dance to it.
Mm-hmm.
The other reason I was talking about being nerds of dance is that our inspirations often come from literary intellectual sources, like we made a dance based on James Joyce's Ulysses, things like that. So, you know, we're kind of nerdy people who just chose choreography as our medium.
We made the mistake of thinking that you should make dances about anything instead of just about being beautiful or transcendent.
I don't think it's a mistake at all. Thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you.
Amy Smith and David Brick are founders of the Headlong Dance Theater. Hotel Pool is currently being performed in Philadelphia and soon goes on tour. For more information, check out our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Gail Harris. Get into your radio and join us again, here and now. For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.